This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Captivate, The Science of Succeeding with People. This is the author, Vanessa Van Edwards. Publisher's note, this audiobook includes a bonus PDF of quizzes, graphs, and illustrations, which can be viewed on any PC or Mac computer. Hi, my name is Vanessa, and I'm a recovering awkward person. At school dances, I'd volunteer to watch the punch bowl. Growing up, if a cool kid accidentally bumped into me, I would start hiccuping uncontrollably. When my family finally got AOL, my first IM buddy was the school nurse. In second grade, I tried to get a permanent dismissal from PE by saying I had menopause pains. If only Google had been around in those days. To prove it, as painful as it is, I present Exhibit A, a photo of me circa 1993. I went for helmet hair without actually playing a sport requiring a helmet, or any sport, frankly, while clinging to the belief that nothing complements a baggy t-shirt quite like a sharp vest, a plaid one, though truthfully, I wasn't too picky in the vest department. On particularly socially anxious days, I would break out in hives right before walking to school and wear long sleeves and pants to cover my swollen, red, itchy limbs. As you might have guessed, the rashes covering my face and scalp didn't help my popularity rankings. It wasn't all bad, though. On Valentine's Day, my teachers gave me cards. Human behavior hacking. It's an understatement to say that people skills did not come naturally to me. I had to learn them the hard way so I could teach them to you the easy way. Here's how it happened. Early on, I figured out that I could learn human behavior just like I studied for math or foreign language tests. I made facial expression flashcards, looked for small talk patterns, and tried to spot the hidden emotions of my teachers, although that last one sometimes got me into trouble. I read everything I could get my hands on about people. Psychology textbooks, sociological studies, and every human behavior book ever written. Eventually, I began to create my own tests and experiments. For one mini experiment, I created flashcards of conversation starters based on studies of dopamine, carried them in my purse, tried them on strangers, and then cataloged their reactions. For another, I tried to adopt the alpha body language moves of chimps to see if people would mirror me. That one did not work. And yet another, I used persuasion techniques in a business pitch competition to see if I could game the system. On a whim, I decided to document all of my misadventures and takeaways as a human guinea pig on a blog, scienceofpeople.com. To my surprise and delight, I found I wasn't the only person struggling to get along with people. As our articles started to pop up all over the web and our videos began going viral, we caught the attention of media outlets like NPR, Inc., and Forbes, which covered our unique approach. This is when I decided to do larger research experiments and turn Science of People into a human behavior lab. In our lab, we start every endeavor by finding the latest scientific studies and then turn them into real-life experiments and tactics. We then share these strategies with our readers and students to test them. In this way, each skill in this book has already been refined by thousands of students who have used them in real-life situations and reported their results back to us to perfect. This method is our secret sauce. Step 1, find fascinating research. Step 2, create actionable, real-life strategies. Step 3, test, tweak, and perfect. Repeat. I call our approach behavior hacking. Over the last 8 years, I have developed shortcuts, formulas, and blueprints for getting along with anyone. Our unique approach has reached millions of students through our online courses and in-person workshops. I've helped corporate teams at Fortune 500 companies increase their interpersonal intelligence, singles make connections at speed dating workshops, and entrepreneurs win pitch competitions using science-based behavior hacks. My columns and appearances in the Huffington Post, in Forbes, and on CNN are seen all over the world by people who want to improve their relationships. We have streamlined all of our best findings into a universal framework that makes up this audiobook. Each chapter of Captivate will teach you one of the 14 behavior hacks. These are simple, powerful tools that you can use to level up your career, improve your relationships, and increase your income. What you will learn. This book will teach you how people work. If you know exactly what makes people tick, you can optimize your behavior, interactions, and relationships. Trying to get along with people without a framework is a bit like solving complex math problems without any equations. It's both difficult and involves a heck of a lot of unnecessary suffering along the way. This book will give you the people skills you never learned in school. As diverse as we all seem on the outside, our inner workings are quite similar. if not eerily predictable. There are hidden rules to human behavior. We just have to find where to look. Part one is all about helping you master the first 5 minutes of any interaction, starting a conversation and creating instant likability. First impressions are fundamental to everything else I can teach you. In part two, I will teach you skills that will help you get to know someone better in the first 5 hours of any interaction. My system for speed reading people and decoding behavior will help you whether you are on the first 5 dates or in the first 5 meetings. I call this system the Matrix. It doesn't involve Keanu Reeves, but it's just as cool. This is what happens when you want to level up a casual connection to something deeper. Part three is about the first 5 days. In order to get to know someone on a deeper level, you have to learn how to influence people, lead teams, and increase your impact with everyone you meet. This is the ultimate level of connection and the final and most advanced step for interacting with people. You will also see that we reference our digital bonuses. These are sections of the book that have corresponding videos, photos, and exercises to help you learn as you go. Get all of the resources at www.scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. To check out the visuals, graphs, and images that go along with this audiobook, see our PDF. Here's my promise. Learning people skills will change your life. Developing your PQ, or interpersonal intelligence, is like adding a catalyst to your success. By the end of the book, you will be able to engage anyone you meet in memorable conversation. You will know how to leave a lasting first impression with clients, colleagues, and friends. And you will have more confidence, control, and charisma in all of your interactions. People with high PQ make on average $29,000 more per year than people with average PQ. 90% of top business performers have high PQ. Individuals with strong interpersonal communication report being 42% happier and more fulfilled with their lives. I joke that people skills are the social lubricant of life. When you understand the laws of human behavior, everything goes more smoothly. Professionally, you will know how to negotiate a raise, connect with colleagues, build rapport at networking events, and nail your elevator pitch. Socially, you will make unforgettable first impressions, reduce relationship drama, enjoy stronger and more supportive friendships, and get along with everyone you meet. Romantically, you will impress your dates, deepen your relationships, flirt authentically, and prevent partner miscommunications. Bottom line, there is a science to winning friends and influencing people, and learning it will completely change the way you interact. Let the adventure begin. Your PQ score. In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun and snap, the job's a game. Mary Poppins. I've developed a quiz to test your people skills, or your PQ. This quiz will help you assess your current level of interpersonal intelligence. The good news is, our PQ can be improved, stretched, and hacked. No matter where you are now, each hack you learn in this book will help you get your PQ up. We will take this test again at the end of the book, and my goal is to help you level up your score by at least 50 points. The full PQ quiz is available in the PDF along with this audiobook. Part 1, the first 5 minutes. Whether you're going to a housewarming party, networking event, or first date, you face the same initial challenges. How do I make a good first impression? Who should I talk to? What should I say? Part 1 is all about the first 5 minutes of an interaction. How can you use your first impression, conversation starters, and introduction to get to know someone? The first 5 hacks are all about tapping into what intrigues people so you can be the most memorable person in the room. Chapter 1. Control. How to win the social game. Once upon a time, a boy named Harry was teased for wearing thick glasses and having a bookish streak. When the time came to apply to college, he took jobs as a timekeeper in a railroad construction company and as a shelf duster in a pharmacy to support his family. No one would have guessed that this shy boy would one day become the 33rd president of the United States. The story of Harry S. Truman is surprising because he doesn't fit the stereotypical booming presidential personality. On July 19, 1944, this posed a problem. Truman was facing the biggest opportunity of his career. He was vying for the vice presidential nomination of the Democratic National Convention. The odds were not in his favor. Then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt had already publicly supported his contender, Henry Wallace, a gifted public speaker, and the current vice president. Truman was not a gifted public speaker, and he knew it. His team had to draw the battle off the main stage to make the convention work to Truman's strength, one-on-one rapport building. All day, they pulled delegates into a private, air-conditioned room underneath the platform called Room H. The convention hall was stiflingly hot, so delegates literally breathed a breath of fresh air as they listened to Truman's pitch and began to cool off. Then he spent hours standing at the end of the hallway, shaking hands with passing members. Instead of waiting for the results in his hotel room, which is what Henry Wallace and most of the other candidates tended to do, Truman ordered a hot dog and sat with his wife in the audience. In the first ballot, Wallace had 429.5 votes, and Truman received 319.5 votes. A second ballot was called immediately. Truman had to win friends, and he had to win them fast. Instead of making a grand speech, Truman and his team kicked into full gear, working party leaders, delegates, and influential members of the crowd one by one. He worked a solid connection with the right person and then let them convince their people for him. At 8:14 p.m., the results were announced. Truman led with 1,031 votes to Wallace's 105. He gained 712 votes in a matter of hours. A few minutes later, Truman gave one of the shortest acceptance speeches in history. He stood patiently at the bank of microphones, and when the audience had finally quieted down, he said, "Now, give me a chance." Want to watch Truman's acceptance speech at the 1944 convention? See all of our extra digital bonus material for this book at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. Truman understood his strengths and played to them. He optimized his interactions for success, and so can you. The science of fake. Imagine it's your dream to play professional basketball. You're fast and have great ball handling skills. You also happen to be 6'2" tall. You have two choices. You could play center, but the average height of an NBA center is 6'11". If you went for center, you would have to fake your height by wearing lifts during games and spending a ton of extra hours after practice working on your vertical jump. Or you could play point guard, where the average height is 6'2". You wouldn't have to make up for extra inches with your jump. You could just focus on playing. Feigning extroversion is like trying to play center with lifts on. Trying to socially fake it until you make it burns a whole lot of extra energy and doesn't really work. It also comes across as inauthentic. In a Science of People survey, we asked 1,036 of our readers the following question. Which of these people habits annoy you the most? A, people who are too talkative. B, people who are too quiet. C, people who are fake. D, people who show off. Can you guess which one? C, people who are fake led the board by far with 63%. D, people who show off was a distant second, 22%. Fake doesn't just happen when you're trying to be something you're not. If you don't like someone, they will feel it. If you are unhappy at an event, people will sense it. Pushing through, faking it, trying to make it work, simply doesn't work. Dr. Barbara Wild and her associates found that our emotions are infectious. First, her team showed people pictures of happy or sad faces. Then they gave them a series of mood tests. They found that they could infect participants with the emotions in each image. Very simply, after viewing a happy face, participants felt more positive. After viewing a sad face, participants felt more negative. Here's what's crazy. They only flashed each image for 500 milliseconds. Only 500 milliseconds is barely enough time for participants to even register they had seen a face, and they still caught the emotion. Dr. Wild even found that our smile muscles unconsciously tend to mimic the smiles around us. We are happier around happy individuals, and we thrive with thriving people. When you force yourself to go to events you are dreading, you are not only miserable, but your misery is contagious. Think you can just fake it till you make it? Think again. We can spot a fake smile a mile away. Over 4,361 people have taken our virtual body language quiz to test their nonverbal intelligence. In one question, we show participants a genuine smile hidden among three fake smiles. Over 86.9% of participants are correctly able to pick out the genuine smile. Researchers at the University of Finland showed one group images of fake smiles and another group images of real smiles. See if you can spot the real or fake smile in the PDF accompanying this audiobook. When participants looked at the real smiles, they felt a positive mood change. But when participants looked at the fake smiles, their mood remained the same. For more on how you can tell the difference, listen to Chapter 6. Faking it until you make it is not worth the effort. Happy people make us happy, but fake happy people, they are forgettable. The first step in winning the social game is to control the situations you play in. Only interact in places where you don't have to fake it. No matter how many behavior hacks you learn, if you go to events that make you unhappy, it will be incredibly difficult to increase your memorability. When you feel great, other people pick up on it and want in on it. When you drag yourself to an event because you feel like you should make an appearance, you are the party pooper, and you smell up the event. This is why you need to have a social game plan. Confidence is contagious, and so is lack of confidence, and a customer will recognize both. Vince Lombardi. Your social game plan. Here's the worst piece of advice I was ever given. Say yes to everything. Say yes to networking events, coffees with strangers, and random conferences, because you never know what opportunity might come your way. As the science shows, this is a big, smelly sack of baloney. Unfortunately, it took me years to figure this out. When I first started my blog, I was trying to find any paid writing gig I possibly could. So almost every weeknight, I trudged out to the professional circuit. I prepared for these networking events like I was going into battle, loading up on fat stacks of business cards, fistfuls of no-nonsense pens, and multiple personalized name tags. My uniform consisted of sensible shoes, casual professional attire, perfume, and a news anchor smile. I fought for attention, for business, for a break from the interminable boredom of having the same conversation over and over again. After 3 years of this nonsense, and at least 10 pounds from eating so many platters of pigs in a blanket, I threw in the towel. I wasn't making any real connections. I wasn't drumming up business, and I certainly wasn't having a good time. Why? I wasn't working to my strengths. Like Truman, I do much better in one-on-one situations. I get overwhelmed by loud rooms with lots of people. Trying to cover up my anxiety with fake smiles just made me come across as inauthentic, and that's the problem. What I needed was a game plan. Hack number one, the social game plan. Take control of your interactions and play by your social rules. Who says you have to play by other people's rules? Not me. I want you to create your own. Your social game plan will help you find the position that's perfect for you, where you play your best, feel the most comfortable, and are set up for the greatest success. Skill number one, play your position. Most people skills books try to force you into one approach, the bubbly extrovert. They want you to fake it until you make it. They expect you to be on all the time with everyone you meet. This is impossible. You can get along with anyone, but you don't have to get along with everyone. The social game plan isn't just about mapping out your strategy. It's also about leveraging your social strengths. Athletes aren't expected to play every position on a team, so you shouldn't try to engage in every social role. Play to your position. This will also make it easier to try all of the hacks you've learned. At our human behavior lab, the Thrive Test asks participants about their favorite places to socialize. Note all of the places where you greatly enjoy spending time with other people. We'll call these your Thrive locations. Bars, nightclubs, restaurants, house parties, cafes, boardrooms, the gym, office meetings, conferences, coffee shops, phone calls, email check-ins, video chat, IM, nature, pool parties, dinner parties, movie night, casinos, concerts, black tie events, cocktail parties, backyard barbecues, theme parks, festivals, networking events, sporting events. Which of those places do you greatly dislike spending time with other people? We'll call these your survive locations. Can you guess which answer was the most popular for the Thrive Test? Trick question, there weren't any clear winners. We couldn't find a statistically significant pattern because the answers were evenly split. Everyone thrives in different scenarios. This is why it's hard trying to learn how to work a party if you don't actually like parties. It's silly trying to learn how to charm people at a conference if conferences make your skin crawl. That's like saying a quarterback should also be able to play as a kicker and linebacker. Maybe he could, but it wouldn't make for a very successful game. Let's identify the positions where you thrive and the ones where you merely survive. Thrive. Think of your three favorite locations from the list above. If you couldn't decide on a location, those are your neutral locations. And the three areas you most dislike spending time are your survive locations. Now you know which invites to say yes to and which ones to skip. Put yourself in a position to be successful before you even arrive. You are much more likely to triumph with each of the behavior hacks if you try them at your thrive locations. And if you have to go to a neutral or survive event, no worries. The next two skills have you covered. Skill number two, work a room. Before you go to an event, imagine drawing your social interactions on a map from the door you enter through to the location of your first conversation to the location of your last. Many of us follow the same paths over and over again without even realizing it. At The Science of People, we partner with event organizers who let us film and track people's movement through the venues. At each event, we assign every attendee a number and then observe his or her interaction patterns. At the end of the night, we count how many connections they made, ask them how many business cards they received, and look at their connections on LinkedIn. We have found that the most successful connectors use specific patterns. In other words, the social map can be hacked. For examples of social maps, check out the PDF along with this audiobook. Whether you're at a networking event, holiday party, wedding, dinner at a friend's house, or in a conference ballroom, most events have the same basic setup. There is a check-in area or a table to drop off gifts. You can easily spot the bathroom and the bar or food area. There are usually a few people you recognize, maybe colleagues, friends, or acquaintances gathered and already catching up. And of course, the host or boss is milling around the room. Let's imagine Truman's social map at the 1944 convention. An audience sat before a big stage. Private meeting rooms were in the back. Most of the candidates devoted their energies to getting on stage before roaming through the audience to do obligatory schmoozing. To be effective and win votes, the shy Truman had to avoid both the typically traversed path and his own personal traps. Truman did his networking at the end of a long hallway on the side of the stage and in the privacy of room H. I call locations that work to our strengths social sweet spots. All Truman had to do was follow his sweet spots to work the room in his favor. I want you to do the same thing. Let's revisit the typical social map. I split every event up into three basic zones, the start zone, the social zone, and the side zone. The start zone is the starting point at all events. Emotionally, it's the place where nerves are running highest. When people have just arrived, they're usually juggling lots of thoughts. They're running late, checking in, taking off their coats, surveying the room, seeing if they know anyone, worrying about first impressions, silencing their phones, running to the bathroom, or praying for a good time. The biggest mistake I see at events is when people hover at the boundary of the start zone. It's a social trap. You're catching people at a confidence low. We noticed that the people who collected the least amount of business cards tried to pounce on people right in the start zone. What they didn't realize was that they were trying to connect with people who weren't open to connection yet. When you approach someone before they get oriented to an event, they are not only more distracted during your conversation, but they will also be looking over your head to scope out the room and find people they know. You'll have a much harder time engaging in eye contact. They're also more likely to excuse themselves to get a drink, grab some food, say hi to the host, or go to the bathroom, and less likely to be receptive to anything you have to say. The side zone is also filled with secret traps that people often fall into. I call it the side zone because we notice that when people fall into these traps, they become sidelined and don't get to meet many new people. The first trap in the side zone is an easy one to remember, the bathroom. Sure, go to the bathroom, but don't hover outside it. It's creepy. The second side zone trap is making a beeline for the food and then floating around it all night. This isn't a terrible trap, but it isn't a great place to plant yourself. Not only will you eat too much and contend with a food baby all night, but you will also make it hard for other people to get their food and eat. It's also difficult to strike up conversations when people are trying to load up their plates, almost impossible to shake hands, and makes for awkward chatting while chewing moments. The third side zone trap is immediately going to people you know. Once you join up with your colleagues, friends, or acquaintances, it is incredibly challenging to get out and meet new people. The best thing to do is wave or give your friends a quick hug when you arrive, and then say you'll circle back to them. You can hang out with them as the crowd thins out, but capitalize on your fresh energy at the beginning of an event to hit the social zone. The social zone is where the magic happens. First, the best place to start working a room is right where people exit the bar. By the time they're here, the emotional, high-anxiety feeling of the start zone will have died down. Drinks in hand, people are ready to mingle, if not desperate to have someone to talk to. You become their savior if you rescue them from drinking alone. There are two sweet spots on either end of the bar. At our networking events, we noticed the people who collected the most business cards and had the most connections on LinkedIn dominated these sweet spots and never ran out of people to talk to. Your opening line can be contextual. How do you like the wine tonight? Or just, hey, cheers, I'm Vanessa. The other great sweet spot in the social zone is right near the host. Once you have your drink, you can continue to work the room by saying a brief hello and thank you to the host. You can also ask them to introduce you around before they carry on greeting people. You can say, thank you so much for having me. This looks like a great group. Anyone I should meet? After they've introduced you, let them do their hosting duties. But if possible, stay in their line of sight. I do this when I don't know many people, because the host is more likely to see me while talking to someone and say, hey, you should meet my friend Vanessa. Vanessa, come over here. Score. Well, I don't recommend standing around the food. Hidden sweet spots are at the couches or bar tables where people are already eating. They're often hoping for someone just like you to set their plate down beside theirs. Something like, hey, can I join you while you eat? Works well. Bonus. If you're an introvert and don't like big groups, I highly recommend being what I call a grazer. Instead of hitting the buffet once for a heaping plate, go up first for appetizers, again for the main course, and then again for seconds or dessert. Why? This is an easy way to take a break from a conversation or move to a new one-on-one. I'm a grazer myself. If I need a longer break, I'll go to the bathroom and refill my drink too. Conserving my social energy helps me have multiple quality conversations in one night. In summary, work a room by hitting your social sweet spots and avoiding common traps. Don't take my word for it. Next time you're at an event, pretend you are on our Science of People observation team. You will notice people moving in and out of traps and sweet spots. Approach me. I've just gotten my food. I'm close to the host. I have a fresh drink in my hand. Avoid me. I'm only talking to people I know. I just got here. Where's the bathroom? Maybe you'll find even deadlier traps or even smarter sweet spots. And you can always redraw your social map based on your skills and goals. I strongly recommend it. Skill number 3, know your team. About 2 weeks after an online body language course I taught went viral, I got a random email from a guy who wanted to give me some unsolicited advice. He told me, in not very nice words, that he thought I should wear a business suit in my videos. In most of my videos, I wear a button-down or a dress. He said I didn't look professional enough, and business wear would appeal to more students. He also advised against using jokes, as they distract from the message. I panicked. I immediately began to think about reshooting my videos to look more formal. Should I start from scratch? Try to edit out clips piece by piece? Devastated, I asked some mentors for advice. Right after I told them the story, one of my mentors asked me, Vanessa, why are you listening to this guy? Is he one of your people? I had no idea what he meant by my people. He explained, your goal is not to reach every person. It's to reach the right people. If this guy gets distracted by what you are wearing, he is not one of the right people. This was a turning point for me and my business. I began to define my ideal student very specifically. Surveys and interviews told me that the people who bought my courses are above average in all areas. They are high performers with above average intelligence and a super busy schedule. My goal is simply to help as many of them as possible. Instead of going after every type of student, I started to target my type of student. With this ideal customer in mind, I began to create short, digestible videos, power-packed with actionable tips. If a video wasn't supercharged with valuable intel or was too wordy, I didn't post it. Within a few months, our business started snowballing. Our YouTube channel views ballooned to over 9 million. Our Twitter followers grew by a factor of 12. As of this writing, we have over 132,000 students in our online courses and over 104,000 in our online community. This only worked because I knew exactly who I was looking for. I found my people. Whether you're trying to find ideal clients, a great partner, or friends who bring out your best self, you have to make sure you are with the right people. You can take the Superman approach, stealthily preventing awkwardness and optimizing your interactions on your own. Or you can partner up. Batman has Robin, Iron Man has Jarvis, and Bert has Ernie. Better yet, you could join the Avengers and have a team to support you. There is an African proverb that says, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together." My question for you is, who are your people? You can accelerate your learning pace by drawing from the strength of others. We all need supporters in our lives, so let's take stock of who's on your team. Listen to the following prompts and think of the person who pops into your head for each. Who do you love spending time with? Who makes you laugh? Who makes you feel valued? Who do you go to when you need to strategize? Who do you most look forward to seeing? Who do you call in a crisis? Who makes you feel like your best self? Who do you wish you could get to know better? Take a moment to think about your answers. Identify the following people. Your winger. Did anyone come up more than once? Is there someone who could join you on a social adventure, who could help you be more comfortable as you try out social hacks, and who shares your desire for growth? I call this person your winger, a gender-neutral form of wingman or wingwoman. Your riser. Is there someone you wish was on this list? We all have people in our lives who we want to improve our connections with. Maybe an office colleague, a new friend, or a potential business contact who could be a career game changer. Use the 14 behavior hacks with your riser to level up the relationship. Knowing what scenarios you thrive in, what positions you're most comfortable in, and what teammates you trust in will save you both energy and time. Use your Thrive List to help you only make social decisions that serve you. Reach out to and rely on the people who truly support you and make you feel valued. Bottom line, you do not have to like everyone. It takes far more work to get along with people or try new behavior hacks in a location that makes you nervous or uncomfortable. By controlling where, how, and with whom your interactions take place, you can set yourself up for more success. I started to say no. I'm not doing that. I don't want to do that. I'm not taking that picture. I'm not going to that event. I'm not standing by that because that's not what I stand for. And slowly but surely, I remembered who I am. And then you go home and you look in the mirror and you're like, yes, I can go to bed with you every night. Because that person, I know that person. That person has balls. That person has integrity. That person has an opinion. Lady Gaga. Taking control. Whether you're a quiet, contemplative conversationalist or a wild, silly party animal, you can succeed by playing to your strengths. When Truman was an unknown senator, for instance, he came up with an ingenious plan for climbing the ladder. The obvious strategy was to speak out on the Senate floor, but Truman preferred research to rhetorical flourishes, so he played the cards he had. He wrote in his memoirs, "Sitting as a hearing committee is a dull, boresome procedure, and it requires patience and persistence. So I soon became the patient and persistent member of the subcommittee." His social game plan was two-pronged. First, he threw himself into researching a topic he knew well from his experience on the railroad, transportation. Then he spent hours in the Library of Congress learning every arcane detail. Second, he built a relationship with a person with similar interests and goals. His riser was Senator Burton K. Wheeler, the chairman of the Interstate Commerce Committee at the time. As Truman showed off his transportation knowledge in committees, he began to level up his relationship with Senator Wheeler. Finally, after Truman dutifully attended many meetings, Wheeler made Truman a formal subcommittee member. Not long after, Wheeler promoted him to vice chairman of the committee. Other senators noticed his work ethic and unique approach for dealing with people, and it carried him all the way up to the White House. Even though Truman might not have been the most traditionally charismatic of individuals, he optimized his skills, mapped out his goals, and worked the right people. Succeeding with people is about engineering what works for you. Challenges. Number one, say no to an event that you are dreading. Number two, at your next event, use the social game plan to find at least two sweet spots. Number three, identify the person who you want to level up, your riser. Keep them in mind while you apply the next 13 hacks. Bonus, reach out to a potential winger about joining your social adventure. Get them this audiobook and invite them to be on your superhero team. Chapter review. There is no one definition of charisma. There are many flavors of social influence, and that's a good thing. The world would be incredibly boring and loud if everyone were an extrovert. We need you. Use your social game plan, show up on your terms, and interact with people who matter to you. Your confidence is contagious. Stop forcing yourself to socialize in ways that drain you. Go where you thrive, avoid where you survive. Say no so you have the energy to say yes. Fill in the blank. My biggest takeaway in this chapter is... Chapter 2. Capture. How to make a killer first impression. The audience sits in hushed anticipation. The Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra is already assembled on stage, tuning their instruments expectantly. The sold-out Heinz Hall is filled with 2,676 people. Everyone is waiting for conductor Ariel Remeret to take the stage. The problem is that Remeret is not supposed to be here. The audience knows it, the orchestra knows it, and Remeret certainly knows it. When the famed German conductor Christoph von Donani became ill a few days before the show, Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra had to find an immediate replacement. They turned to Remeret. In a matter of days, Remeret, a tall, energetic Norwegian, had to find a way to learn and conduct Donani's entire program with an orchestra he had never worked with before. Of the three scheduled pieces in the program, Remeret had only ever conducted one before in concert. When I interviewed Remeret, he confessed, "Before walking out, I was incredibly nervous and was going on almost no sleep to get ready for the performance." To add even more pressure, New York Times reviewer James R. Estreich was in the audience. As Remeret finally takes the stage, the audience holds its breath. He has only a few seconds to make a strong first impression. For Remeret, it's all about finding a way to create trust. He has to convince the audience that he can lead them through a new set and show the orchestra they should follow him. He approached the podium like a diffident schoolboy, but once there, he showed utter self-assurance, using clear and wide-ranging gestures, observed Estreich. Remeret leads the orchestra through a sensational performance of Wagner's Siegfried Idol, and then a dynamic reading of Schumann's Fourth Symphony. He finishes with Brahms' Second Piano Concerto and finally a Chopin waltz as the encore. The audience is thrilled. "The only thing listeners seemed to want to talk about afterward was Mr. Remeret," reported Estreich. "Mr. Remeret radiated a joy in music making," several listeners said. Inevitably, his boyish good looks, expressive podium manner, and understated charisma were noted, but so was what some perceived as an unusual rapport between conductor and players. The news of Remeret's magnetic performance spread. He was quickly rehired in Pittsburgh and made additional debuts with the Baltimore Symphony, Milan's Filarmonica della Scala, Munich Philharmonic, and the Vienna Symphony. "The musicians know within 5 minutes whether a new conductor is any good or not," he said later. What did he do right in those first 5 minutes? The science of first impressions. Have you ever met someone you just clicked with? Within the first few seconds, you somehow knew that you would get along. Have you ever met someone who rankled you right from the start? You don't know exactly what it was, but something about them just bothered you. Whether we like to admit it or not, we decide if we like someone, if we trust someone, and if we want a relationship with someone within the first few seconds of meeting them. However, we rarely think about our first impressions, and if we do, we aren't quite sure how to make them better. So we practice what we want to say, we plan witty jokes, and hope for the best when it comes to those early moments. Researchers Nalini Ambati and Robert Rosenthal at Harvard University wanted to test the power of our snap judgments. They decided to look at students' perceptions of their professors. Our judgments of teachers should only be based on their actual teaching content, not on their looks, behavior, or presence. However, this is not how we operate. For the experiment, Ambati and Rosenthal showed muted 10-second video clips of professors teaching to outside participants who rated the teachers on 15 dimensions of effectiveness, including warmth, optimism, and professionalism. The evaluators had to make judgments based entirely on nonverbal cues. Ambati and Rosenthal looked at the results and wondered if they could change the ratings by shortening the clips. So they cut the clips from 10 seconds to 5 seconds. The ratings did not change. Then they cut the clips from 5 seconds to 2 seconds. The ratings still did not change. They concluded that we make a snap judgment in the first 2 seconds of meeting someone, and we rarely adjust it, even when we get more information. We decide if we believe someone, if we like someone, and if we trust someone before we have even heard him or her speak. What character judgments could you confidently make after watching someone move in a room for 2 seconds? Could you guess how honest they are? How nice? How supportive? Even though you would have very little content to judge, you already mentally ask and answer these questions within seconds of meeting someone. And the crazy part is, you're pretty accurate. Here's the most interesting part of the study. Ambati and Rosenthal took the ratings from each of these clips and compared them to the student evaluations of these same teachers after an entire semester of classes. Again, they were surprisingly similar. Teachers who got poor rankings from the 2-second clips also got low rankings from students who took a semester's worth of classes. You can bet that those teachers spent many hours agonizing over their curriculum, practicing their teaching method, and spending time bonding with students before and after classes. According to Ambati and Rosenthal, this is not what really mattered. Students decide how effective teachers are within the first few seconds of walking into the room. The same thing happens to Rema Ray when he takes the stage. And the same thing happens to you when you enter a room. Intimidated by the speed of the first impression? Don't be. This is good news. If it takes only a few seconds to convince someone you are worth talking to, let's supercharge those first few seconds. You can use the first impression to hack an entire interaction. Leveling up. First impressions are a survival mechanism. When you meet a new person, you have to quickly decide if you want them in your life. Ever heard of the fight or flight response? It is a way your body instinctively reacts to external stimuli and decides if you should stay or flee. This is why first impressions are so swift and decisive. We are trying to answer 3 basic questions about a new person during the first few moments of an interaction. Level 1. Are you friend or foe? This is our subconscious personal safety check. We're thinking, darling, you gotta let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Level 2. Are you a winner or loser? When we first meet someone, we want to quickly assess their confidence. Do they look like a leader or a follower? Level 3. Are you an ally or an enemy? It's one thing to see someone as non-threatening, but the last level is when you decide whether someone should be on your team. Your brain wants to know if this person likes you enough to back you up. When someone successfully answers all 3 questions, we level up and trust them more. Strangers become acquaintances, acquaintances become friends, prospects become clients. These are, of course, the 3 questions people are also trying to quickly answer about you. How does this phenomenon play out when a speaker is in front of a big audience? In a TED Talk, for example. I'm a TED Talk junkie. Most days, I find a juicy talk at lunch to accompany my sandwich. One day, I typed leadership into the search bar and 2 videos popped up. One was How Great Leaders Inspire Action by Simon Sinek. And the other was Learning from Leadership's Missing Manual by Fields Wicker Murin. Both talks were about 18 minutes long. Both talks came out in September of 2009. Both talks were given by respected thought leaders in their field. But there was one difference, and it was a big one. CynicsTalk had 24,905,052 views, while Wicker Murin's talk had only 725,663 views. Why such a big discrepancy? By virtue of being selected for TED Talks, both speakers were vetted prior to their presentation. TED goes to great lengths to keep their presentation style consistent and pick the best speakers from around the world. All of these speakers have amazing ideas. What gives? I designed a research experiment in our lab to find out. We wanted to see if Ambadi and Rosenthal's findings could be applied to TED. First, we had a group of participants watch full-length TED Talks and give each speaker a score on credibility, charisma, intelligence, and overall performance. Participants were not able to see the view counts to avoid skewing their perceptions, and we verified they had not seen the talks before. Next, we gave scoring sheets to a second group who saw 7-second clips of the same TED Talks. Guess what? No significant difference in opinion. Is it possible that we decide if we're going to like a TED Talk within the first 7 seconds? How do the top TED Talkers pass through all 3 levels of trust so quickly? We had our coders analyze hundreds of hours of TED Talks looking for differences between the least and most viewed videos. We counted hand gestures and measured vocal variety, smiling, and body movement. We found there were patterns. The power of our first impression lies not in what we say, but how we say it. The most popular TED Talkers leveled up their audience before even getting to their big idea. They did this by using what I call hack number 2, the triple threat. Make a powerful first impression by non-verbally hacking all 3 levels of trust. In showbiz, performers are a triple threat when they can act, sing, and dance. With a first impression, you are a triple threat when you use your hands, your posture, and your eye contact. These are the 3 nonverbal weapons you can use to pass through all 3 levels of trust. These are what Ariel Dremeret uses when he enters the stage. They are what the top TED Talkers use on that little red carpet. And they are what you should use anytime you're interacting with someone. Skill number 1, use your hands. The top TED Talkers use a very specific mechanism to instantly build trust with their audience, hand gestures. The least popular TED Talkers used an average of 272 hand gestures. Yes, our coders painstakingly counted every single one. The most popular TED Talkers used an average of 465 hand gestures. That's almost double. Temple Grandin, Simon Sinek, and Jane McGonigal topped the hand gesture charts with over 600 hand gestures in just 18 minutes. This effect isn't specific to TED Talks. Robert Gifford and his team found that job candidates who use more hand gestures in their interviews are more likely to get hired. Why do hand gestures have such an impact? Hands show intention. Think back to caveman days for a moment. When a stranger approached our caveman ancestors, the best way to tell if the stranger had good or bad intentions was to look at their hands. Were they carrying a rock or a spear? As the stranger introduced themselves, our ancestors watched their gestures to make sure they weren't going to reach out and attack or steal precious belongings. Even though in modern times we aren't often subjected to physical harm, this survival mechanism remains. This is why in most cultures we shake hands as a way of greeting. And why the first thing police officers yell at criminals is, "Get your hands up." When someone can see your hands, they feel more at ease and are more likely to befriend you. This is an easy one to implement. When you walk into a room or are waiting to meet someone, keep your hands out of your pockets. I know, putting your hands in your pockets is so comfortable. It's so casual. It's so cowboy. I don't mean to get drastic, but pockets are murderers of rapport. Yeah, I said murderers. That's because the absolute easiest thing you can do to improve your first impression is to keep your hands visible. Every time you put your hand in your pocket, just scream "murderer" in your head. That will help you remember. Pockets aren't the only problem. Don't let desks, purses, or laptops block your friend makers. Whenever possible, keep your hands above the desk in a boardroom, on the table during a coffee meeting, and out of your purse during an event. Getting handsy is a 1-2 punch for trust. First, you have your hands visible, and then you go in for the perfect handshake. How to give the perfect handshake. Are you friend or foe? A handshake shows a stranger you are safe enough to go palm to palm. Not all handshakes are created equal. Here are the top things you need to know about a great handshake. Dry. Nothing is worse than a slimy handshake. If you get nervous and your palms sweat, use my favorite napkin wrap trick. When you get to an event, order a drink from the bar and wrap a napkin around the glass. Hold this with your handshaking hand so the napkin catches your sweat before you shake. Vertical. Always keep your hand vertical with your thumb toward the sky. Offering your palm up is a nonverbal submissive or weak gesture. And forcing someone into the palm up position by putting your hand out palm down can be seen as domineering and controlling. Firm. Have you ever squeezed a peach to see if it was ripe? This is kind of the effect you want when shaking a hand, because everyone has a slightly different idea for firmness. With a peach, you squeeze until you feel a tiny bit of resistance. If it's really ripe, this comes fast and you stop squeezing. If it's not ready to be eaten, you can squeeze pretty hard without bruising the fruit. Same goes for people. Squeeze until you feel their muscles tighten, and then stop. And for goodness sake, never give someone a limp handshake, aka the dead fish. It's deadly for rapport. Want more handshake tips? Find out what to do if someone's handshake is too strong, or if you don't like touch, or how to handle the double handshake. Watch our digital bonus video at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. Never, ever skip a handshake. Don't replace it with a wave or a high five, or heaven forbid, a fist bump. Why? The moment we have skin-to-skin touch with someone, our body produces something called oxytocin. Oxytocin is the connection hormone. Researcher Paul Zak discovered the power of this little hormone, which he calls the moral molecule, to facilitate trust. This is why it is an essential part of answering the question, friend or foe. 2 million people have viewed his TED Talk. In it, he describes conducting experiments with oxytocin, in which he manipulated the trust of participants simply by giving them a dose of the hormone. When you shake hands with someone, your body produces the exact hormone you both need to build trust, and then a deeper connection. Bottom line, keep your hands visible. Never skip a handshake. Skill number 2, be a winner. In the PQ quiz in the PDF, I asked you, what is the most influential factor for professionals who want to earn the trust of potential clients? A. Being an established, proven expert. B. Having a high degree of confidence. C. Demonstrating advanced expertise in their area. D. Having a well-respected reputation. What did you guess? If you guessed B, having a high degree of confidence, you are correct. According to a major study done by Carnegie Mellon University, a professional's confidence is more important than that professional's reputation, skill set, or history. Why is confidence so important? As humans, we are constantly looking for winners. Winner, noun, victor, a person likely to be successful. We like to have winners on our team. We like to be associated with winners. We like to be led by winners. Whether we like it or not, in the first few seconds of an interaction, we are trying to decide if the person we are speaking with looks more like a winner or more like a loser. The question is, what does a winner look like? Researchers Jessica Tracy and David Matsumoto wanted to know if there are universal winner and loser behaviors. Specifically, they examined how humans respond to success and failure. To do this, they compared how Olympic athletes behave after they win or lose a race. Do sighted, blind, and congenitally blind, blind since birth, athletes display the same forms of pride and shame after a match? The answer is yes. Across cultures, the behavior of winning and losing athletes was the same. Even congenitally blind athletes who have never seen an athlete finish a race or suffer a crushing defeat somehow mimic the gestures of other athletes. Winners typically take up as much space as physically possible. Frequently called power posing, this is when we raise our arms over our head, expand our chest, and tilt our head up. For this audiobook, I was standing and made sure that I took up as much space as possible while recording. So right now, I have both of my hands on my hips, and my feet are at least hip-width apart. I want you to hear how different it sounds if I cross my arms over my chest and cross my legs. When I stand like this, you can hear that I'm more likely to go into vocal fry, and it's much harder to have high power in my voice. Whew! Now back to power posing. Losing athletes take up as little physical space as possible, also known as low power posing. Defeated athletes usually bow their head, slump their shoulders, and pin their arms tightly to their sides. The fact that athletes instinctively use the same body language shows us how innately programmed we are to broadcast victory and defeat non-verbally. But why? Tracy and Matsumoto propose that pride and shame factor significantly in social signaling, providing rich information we use to make judgments of ourselves and others. Like athletes, when we are proud, we want people to notice us, so we take up space. When we feel defeated, we try to deflect attention by taking up as little space as possible. Now, as much as I want you to look like a winner, the traditional winner's pose is a bit much for everyday interactions. It would be odd if you ran into your meetings or dates like you just crossed a finish line. Highly powerful, but a bit socially aggressive. Instead, I use something I call the launch stance. This is a slightly toned